Hey, welcome to Escape from Plan A. This is Teen hosting this week, and I'm here with Jess. What is going on, Jess? How you doing?
The sun finally came out in Los Angeles, so this is big news.
Okay, so back to normal. Everything's fine. No more problems.
For now. It's just surprisingly cool. Unseasonably cool. But I'll take it. I hear it's going to be really hot in the next couple of months.
So you're good.
Yeah, for the moment, yeah.
And we got a guest, a friend of mine who I've hosted some Twitter spaces with, and I've really enjoyed talking with him on Twitter and in real life, John Peng. How's it going, John?
Hi, Dean.
There's that nice Malaysian accent, that learned accent. Love hearing it.
Don't know about learned, but it's Malaysian.
It's scholarly. You're learned. It's very scholarly.
Yeah, he's learning.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so
it was great catching up with you,
scholar John Peng. He kindly graced us with his presence here on this pod today.
No, I'm thrilled to be here. I'm huge fans of this pod. I don't want to embarrass you, but you know, sometimes
embarrassing. You just keep saying it.
Good.
I'm really looking forward to this. It's going to be a good conversation, I think.
Yeah. So, yeah. Me too.
Yeah.
Okay. So to set the scene, I think that. A couple weeks ago, it's probably out of the news cycle, but the Chinese clothing company Shein, S-H-E-I-N, which we were just talking about, we can go into how quickly it's growing and sort of what market segment it's in. But they were, you know, controversy has followed them around. They sell what's called fast fashion, virtually disposable clothing. Think of them as like the IKEA of clothing, maybe even cheaper than that. And, you know, the clothes that they sell are extremely trendy. They sell a huge amount of clothes. They have a huge amount of market share. And, you know, and kind of in a first, I would think this is like a dominant Chinese brand, which we haven't seen in America or in the West, really. You know, usually we see Chinese made products, but branded by, you know, either a European brand such as an H&M or a Zara, or a Japanese brand like a Uniqlo, even though most of their clothing is made in China. And controversy has followed China around because their price point's even lower than these other competitors. And allegations of, you know, labor abuse have been rampant. And in reaction to that, if you recall, Shein had invited some, you know, popular online fashion influencers from like Instagram and TikTok to come and visit a factory. I wouldn't say the factory. I'm sure they have many factories to show that, in fact, you know, the conditions are good, that the machine, you know, they're using high tech machinery, and that's how they do it. And that invited a lot of blowback to say that this was, you know, a sort of a bit of propaganda, let's say, and they were employing Western influencers to sort of, you know, shine a turd. And a lot of, you know, there was a lot of blowback in the media. Mainstream media was calling this, you know, another brand trying to gloss over its abusive labor practices, et cetera. So that got me thinking about, you know, just sort of like, and this is a wide open topic, right, guys? I haven't given like a specific outline of like, you know, exactly what I'm trying to say here, but just open up a discussion because I think we're all interested in this, in terms of, you know, our attitudes towards labor and Asian labor in particular, because I think that's where we get a lot of problems in terms of how we talk about it, how we claim to care about it. But I think in the end, a lot of it is concern trolling, and just, I think you called it, you know, a fig leaf to cover up what I think is a deeply ingrained hostility to labor in the West, which is hidden and obfuscated, but it is a hostility towards labor itself. And also, I think a good amount of racism that's been that finds its way into it. So
I mean, you covered a huge amount of terrain there, and hopefully you can pick apart some of the pieces that are of interest. But it's a fascinating story, actually. So I had just noted with you guys prior to this call, despite this company being one of the three it's $100 billion company. It's considered the world's third largest company as of 2023, just after ByteDance and SpaceX. Yes, it's a massive company. And yet, despite its sheer size, no one has probably heard of this company, say 2-3 years ago. And I wasn't even sure how to pronounce it. That's how dominant it is without actually being above ground necessarily in the consumer's consciousness, like to the point where I don't even know how to pronounce its name properly. Like it was like Shein, who really knows? But the sheer size of it indicates something kind of interesting to me. Like I think it's actually a great business case study. This Shein did something that MBAs said was impossible in America. Like literally impossible. Entire brands have written playbooks on how to properly build a business, how to scale, how to market to the American consumer, how to target the consumer. And Shein basically undid the entire thing. It turns out the American consumer is fighting on the exact same terms as the Asian consumer, the African consumer, big portions of the European market, and it's simply price. So there's a layer to this controversy that's the polite reservations and complaints that we are willing to express in public. And then there's our private behavior, which is to buy massive amounts of extremely cheap goods from this company, presumably against our ingrained instincts, like what you're talking about, right? Like racism or the hostility to Asian labor, the devaluing of Asian labor and Asian made and openly Asian made products, and all of that flew out the window to make this this the world's third largest company, primarily from the North American consumer. So there's a dual consciousness, I think, that's in play here that I think is actually very interesting. And I haven't seen it mentioned in the press very much, despite this being a very pivotal story in the present reality and the near future of the consumer marketplace in North America. Primarily, I'm talking primarily the U.S., of course.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, what do we know about Shein? John, do you know? I mean, I actually don't know that much about this company other than, you know, I think that the sort of long arc history to me, right? And I'll just tell you what I think of this controversy is, and people may accuse me of being defensive about Chinese companies where this is a company that doesn't deserve protection, but I'm not trying to protect Shein. I'm just trying to make, and I don't, you know, I've only been to their website once and it gave me a headache. I mean, I got right off. This is not a company that I have any interest in as a consumer, right? But I would say that if you look at the clothing industry in the U.S., the retail clothing industry, I mean, China has been the workshop for almost like, you know, for decades. We've gotten extremely used to products made in China and generally don't really have a problem with it. I know that, you know, this controversy has come up before when when people had raised, some of the deindustrialization, that a lot of jobs were being moved to China and Asia, and Nike had run into this problem, this controversy before. But for the most part, I think it kind of died down. We hadn't seen it again, including through, you know, a lot of fast fashion and sort of near fast fashion, like some of the brands that I mentioned before. But then it blew up again in a spectacular way. And I think the reason is because we're okay with things being made in China. We're not okay with the brand being Chinese. And I think the reason is because if you look at the profit margin, like who's making the bulk of the profit off of clothing retail, so far it really hasn't been, in my estimate. I don't think it's the people who make the clothes. I think it's the people who market the clothes, right? It's the I forgot his name, but it's the Uniqlo guy who is the founder, who is the richest man in Japan. The richest man in Japan is the Uniqlo founder, and they're selling blazers for $50, And they're good. I mean, I own Uniqlo stuff. They're really good. They're pretty. They're not disposable clothes at all. Yep. But and they're selling for cheap. And I don't think anyone's really had a problem with the fact that 80%, I looked that up, 80% of their clothes are made in China. And they have enough of a markup on that clothes that they can run a huge brick and mortar retail footprint, you know, employees in those stores, as well as advertising, as well as enough markup that the owner is now, the founder is now the richest man in Japan. So I feel like that the brand is the one that's really, you know, riding the coattails of Asian labor and Chinese labor here. And so I don't know. It just,
and the Chinese market is by far the largest number of stores in China.
Yep. There you go. And so I feel like it's a case where the, you know, playing in a bit of a nationalistic sense, that Chinese workers are allowed to put their wares out into the global market, but they can't sell it directly. They cannot brand it themselves. They can't take the lion's share of the profit. They can only be back-end white label producers for Western and, in some instances, Japanese brands.
I'm curious who you are referring to when they say they can't, because the American consumer has voted with their wallets, and the answer is resoundingly yes. If everyone had this as a deeply seated belief, Shine wouldn't have become the company that it is. So it's kind of a dual consciousness. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a dual consciousness here. There's what we say we care about, and there's what we actually care about. And I think perhaps a big part of the friction here is that it's exposing that double consciousness in a very uncomfortably visible way. I mean, if I may be so crude.
Yeah, like, it's not just double consciousness. There is this in the TikTok example. Pardon me for interrupting.
Oh, of course.
Fascinating dimension here. You know, with TikTok, you had a kind of political and media elite sort of, talking it down. And then you find out that there's 100 million Americans who are really keen on it. And these are regular people. And I think it's not just double consciousness. There's a certain sort of elite, a discourse elite. And then there's regular people who probably don't have this issue.
Yes, exactly.
If you know what I mean, there's that division. There's an intra-American division, or there's a societal division here.
Yes, absolutely. Sure. So in a sense, their position in the, like, Shine especially, to me, if I may be so crude. The most apt analogy for me is that it's somewhat akin to, like, pornography, but for consumer-driven capitalism. It's a very naked exposure of what of the id of a consumer's actual desires here. One part that was interesting to me about the controversy, really, it was a tempest in a teacup. It didn't affect Shine's bottom line. It affected nothing in their operations. It was barely a ripple that the majority of people did not pay any attention to, or they saw the headlines on their way to placing another order with them. If you look at, and it was funny that so many people involved in the controversy actually had not even looked at the site. So I invite anybody listening to this to actually look at this. If you're not a customer already, and I know a lot of you are, or if you aren't, then, you know, someone close to you is, and that just take a look at what they offer. It is extremely clear what they are competing on. It is blazing. It is capitalism at its most naked form. It's kind of astonishing and impressive to see. Almost, you know, borrowing from TikTok's playbook. TikTok was not supposed to succeed. I work in technology myself. I was told years ago that the social media market was essentially closed. All the big players had staked their claims. There was no more territory to compete on, even with all the power of, like, American VC, Silicon Valley behind you, that this is just not possible anymore. And this little upstart from China, of all places, are, you know, And they really slipped under the radar. I think they entered the U.S. market just right before the COVID-related wave of like anti-China policy really started bubbling up into the mainstream consciousness. They competed strictly on a laser targeted algorithm. And they are able to allocate tremendous amounts of attention and now money. They are one of the biggest money movers in the American tech marketplace, if not the biggest, to completely dominate the environment here. So, you know, as a business, this is kind of a case study in just how competing on the things you're supposed to compete on yield tremendous rewards, backed by the sheer size and capability of China, which has spent, you know, the last several decades building up this kind of human capital, social capital, economic capital to be able to make these kinds of big pushes now. So when you're talking about like what we know about Shine took off. I think the precursor to Shine was the plethora of Chinese companies that were selling on Amazon, kind of a direct to consumer under the Amazon umbrella. So Amazon takes a cut. A lot of Chinese manufacturers set up a shop and then just sell their wares through that. And then that business model primed the American consumer for extremely low prices. They actually primed the consumer on accepting, exchanging like a guarantee of quality for sheer price and volume and speed with which they could receive their items. And then it was kind of inevitable. Like some people were actually predicting this, that the Amazon, some company would break away from, you know, paying rents to Amazon to completely dominate this segment of the American retail market. And lo and behold, that actually became true, and it became true much quicker and faster than anyone had ever anticipated. So I'm rambling a little bit, but
I'm intrigued by sorry. Go on.
Well, I think what Jess is saying is that what she's talking about, you know, the idea that there would be one of these sort of no brand, you know, online retailers that's just selling cheap stuff through, an Amazon or whatever. The forbidden thing, the idea of them breaking out and becoming their own retailer and brand was forbidden, in the sense that if that were to happen and they started becoming extremely successful, there would be a concerted effort to shut that down, because that to me is taking away the profit margins of what we would call American capitalism, which is, you know, the Asians make it, we sell it. And you're just the back room. It's like a restaurant.
There's a huge story here. Yeah. About the whole structure of the global economy and something at stake right now.
Well, let me a minor correction. Directionally, you are correct. I'll make a minor one minor correction to that. Is it the common understanding was that it wouldn't, though. This is the interesting part to me. Part of my life as a tech consultant was actually helping companies build their brand presences. It was very, very emphasized, especially your technology-based company where you're interfacing with the consumer through a very impersonal digital medium like a website. It was very important to build that kind of brand trust and presence and kind of a faux personalization of what you and your company stood for. This is why, you know, you see all these profiles of founders, like people behind the scenes. Yep. You make, you know, a lot of emphasis on friendly user experience and, you know, user interfaces that are very polished and sophisticated as kind of an extension of a brand identity. So the common assumption when we talked about, you know, people were predicting like China is building up its raw capacity so quickly that it's inevitable that somebody would try to break out like this, right? And, you know, mind you, before in the 5-6 years prior to Shine entering the market as its own for, you know, Shine or TikTok or any of these other companies, you know, there were storefronts on Amazon, operating like Shenzhen or Guangzhou or something that were doing, you know, tens of millions of dollars a year in revenue just from, you know, their Amazon storefronts. But the common understanding was that none of them would be able to break out because none of them would be able to build on that human, personalized, sophisticated brand identity that the American consumer, American and European consumer, needs in order to be able to trust them with their money.
Oh, yeah. So no, I totally agree. I think we just got used to the smell of our own farts when it came to that thing. You know?
And it turns out...
And the law of the marketplace still holds. And that's the thing that bothers us, is that if they're given a fair shake, you know, if they have... And I think that the internet has collapsed access to that marketplace where, you know, Shine has as easy a time to reach the consumer directly as an Amazon does or any other retailer. That, you know, the promise of, you know, a fair competition online is anathema to the business, the high margin business model of US retail. And I think this applies across the board where, you know, we're just simply not comfortable with the people who make stuff being the people who also sell it. We are very comfortable with a global supply chain model or whatever you want to call it, but basically a form of global capitalism where certain people are lower on the food chain. They're the ones, and Asia, I think, exemplifies this. And I think Southeast Asia is very much a part of this. Maybe, John, I don't know if you have any special insight there as to how that works in Southeast Asia, but some economies are just geared towards export. And that, you know, and then the people of that country are meant to be workers and suppliers. They're givers into the supply chain, but they're not
takers. That's the whole structure of the global economy. And everything that was presumed about the way things work over the so-called neoliberal era, right, from the 1990s onwards, and Malaysia, where I come from, and Southeast Asia, where I was active, sort of the embodiment of that assumption in terms of its development models. So you did certain things. You start with textiles, right, as a lot of industrialization does. It's very interesting because textile is fundamental to industrialization. And you were supposed to start on the low end and so on and move all the way up. So you know, this discussion is really interesting on two levels, as you've identified. There is this thing here in which they're taking over at the branding and retail and marketing side of it, and also the storefront. And this is the high value end stuff at the end that's supposed to be dominated, has always been dominated by Western companies and a particular, you know, Japanese company, right? So the rest of it, all that other work, lower value stuff is supposed to be done elsewhere. It could be Bangladesh, it could be Vietnam, right? Or China. I wanted to get back at something just said, you know, and ask you more about this. You said it's like pornography. I mean, Chris, I want to say more. You know, I tried downloading this, right, and going through it, and I have no interest in it because this stuff is it's tailored to obviously a kind of younger women. It's tailored to women and probably younger women. But I want to get at the innovation in business model. Not just technology, not just the algorithms, but in the entire sort of business model. And I tend to look at it. I don't know Shine so well, but I know TikTok a little better. I've used Temu, AliExpress out here. And there seem to be certain similarities between them, except that unlike Temu and Ali, where the particular retailers come on to this sort of broad marketplace and just sell, these guys are everything. I mean, this is like Uniqlo, but without the stores, the physical stores. They take that over as well. So the business model innovation is actually massive. You know, it is extremely threatening to traditional clothing retailers.
Yeah, it's actually
very, very niche, right? Cheap and fast. Is it just super fast? Do you mean it's pornography in that sense? There is this whole thing about fast fashion, right? Is this just fast fashion on steroids?
It is. It's a lot of things, actually. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's actually a mistake to see them as primarily a clothing brand. A lot of their sales are actually in electronics, appliances, mm-hmm. home goods, you know, cosmetics and things like mm-hmm. that, things that wouldn't traditionally be considered clothing. A huge mm-hmm. amount of volume. I'm on the site right now. I just clicked electronics. Like, let me tell mm-hmm. you just exactly how hilariously wild this company is and just how much it flouted every single precept about brand building and business mm-hmm. model development in the country.
Right.
On their top page, so they're Shein, the main site, you click, you know, into one of their subcategories, you click into appliances, they don't even spell appliances correctly. Yep. There is a typo barely two clicks away from the top page. And this is $100 billion company, right? This is how I'm not making fun of them. I'm saying that this is just how flagrantly they have decided to just base. They probably hired a lot of very high paid consultants to develop their brand, to develop a business model for deployment in the United States to cater to the American consumer, and they are ignoring everything. This is wild. I haven't seen it analyzed as such.
It's wild, but, and so it works, which is interesting.
It's wild and it works.
Yes, you're kind of saying that they're not really that worried about, you know, crossing their T's and dotting their I's. They're just moving. They're just moving cargo.
Because you worry about that when you're trying to extract that surplus value, right? When you're talking about brand building, right? That gap between, you know, your labor and your material inputs and the profit margin you can expect to skim, you know, your brand identity sits in that. It's the personification of surplus value, right? It's how much the premium the consumer will pay on top of the raw inputs. Shein is saying, fuck you. How would you like a set of speakers for $3?
Right.
The speaker for $3, you don't need to spell. It's not quite branding the
thing itself.
Yes,
it's a storefront for these, you know, millions of Chinese retailers and hundreds of thousands of producers, factories, and so on, whose great weakness.
Knockoffs.
The one shortfall was they didn't have brand. They didn't have brand presence.
Mm-hmm. Right? And right now it's hilarious.
And this guy is just doing it.
Yes.
For all of them.
Right now there is a knockoff of the Apple Pro Max headset, the AirPods. For $18. Oh,
I've seen an unboxing of some of those.
See?
They go there's ones that go for like, you know, like $18 and mm-hmm. there's ones that go for $100.
Yeah, and this is kind of the marketplace for all of it. Yeah, this is
the $100 ones are not, you know, they're not real AirPods, and they don't sound like real AirPods, but they're not shit either. And the, you know, you know, it's you know what this reminds me of, people? It reminds me of when I was a kid, when Price Club, which is now Costco, when Costco first got running, and suddenly the idea was, screw the nice mall storefront, screw the nice salespeople, we're just going to throw everything to a giant bin and just stack them on pallets, and you guys pick them. You guys pick at it. Like, just go to the wholesale store, like, you know, like the retailers would. You just go, if this is wholesale direct to consumer, and it blew people's minds at the time, but over time it became a preferred way of shopping because, you know, it turned out that a lot of consumers didn't need or didn't want to have this sort of like glossy retail barrier between them and the product. They just wanted to get to the product. And I'm looking at, there's this guy, the whole Shein thing came to my attention because he's actually Asian American. There's a pretty big account on Twitter called Derek Guy. It's called Die Fat.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
He's actually really
You should really
account.
Get into this. This is what got me interested. Your interaction, your
with
tweets.
Derek Guy, right.
Yeah, we do need to get to that.
We absolutely do, because that was a fascinating thing to watch.
That was a fascinating thing, and Teen's reaction to it was also fascinating. So
Look, I am more hostile on Twitter than I am on. Well, sometimes I can be hostile on this pod too, but I want reasoned discussion, and I don't really have a problem with Derek Guy, even though he blocked me. But I would say that there are things that he said that both are very illuminating and also undercut his point. His point is that you simply can't make clothes at this level without, you know, just really, really bad levels of like worker abuse. And he said that we should abandon, you know, Shein should be destroyed or abandoned because there's no way that you can produce clothes at that price point without basically killing your workers in suicide net factories, which is a whole other fucking thing that we can talk about later. But taking what he says for a sec, I mean, there's a, he posted a graph, which I think is really interesting. And I'll describe it to you. It's a graph that compares Shine to Zara and H&M in terms of like different the amount of actual selection. And Shine is, you know, if you look at dresses, pants, shoes, and t-shirts, the total number of different articles is approaching 150,000. Whereas Zara looks to be, it's so low, Zara and H&M are so low as to be almost negligible. It looks like they're about in the, maybe the 2,000 or 3,000 range. Maybe.
Yes, they're they're on the clothing side. Their business model is extreme innovation. So like John said, it is fast fashion on steroids. So fast fashion, defined by brands like H&M, Zara, you know, Forever 21, which practically look like heritage brands in comparison to this. They release maybe like 10, 12 collections a year. They iterate over a period of 6 weeks. Some of it is ripped off from like, you know, couture, you know, high-end designers in Europe who only do 2 or 3 collections a year, you know, and then that was considered blazing fast. Shine does iterations in a period of days, if not hours. They monitor social media to see what sells, what doesn't sell. Things can go in and out of stock while you are surfing on the site. I'm not a customer, but you know, I know, just being a woman, I know, you know, I've just seen how this works. It is an insanely sophisticated model that's very, very responsive and predicated on extreme high throughput at the expense of quality. Right? Flexibility.
Hold on. Here's my take on this. Now, I don't have the facts. I'm positing a theory. I'm not saying I'm right. Mm-hmm. But this is what I look at this graph. Again, I mean, if you could see the graph in front of you, you know, we're not on video, so I can't show you. But just think of Shine as, you know, 50x a Zara or H&M in terms of number of different, you know, SKUs or whatever you want to call them in the retail world, right? Items. Now, the way I see this is, Zara and H&M both are European brands. What you just said there, Jess, in terms of doing the research, you know, figuring out what styles or whatever, that was the brand's job. And the way the model worked for a worked and continues to work, and it's been this way for a long time, is that the Chinese textile factories and Southeast Asian and, you know, South Asian factories were basically just sort of like back end, you know, processors of orders. Exactly. Specs came in for designs and they didn't care. They were just like, you just tell me what you want and the number of articles and the quality level and I will produce. And then we can write a contract and I'll produce it for you. But your job is to figure out what you want and then take the risk on the order. Right. And I think what happened is that in China, let's take it as one of a few textile superpowers in terms of manufacturing, is if that's what your business model is, then this is actually, the flexibility was already built in. They already had to be able to produce any number of articles the second that a Western retailer said, okay, I want a crop top that looks like this, and I want a little thing here, and then boom, out the door. The flexibility and to produce a huge number of different items to spec was already there because the workers had to get that good and that flexible in order to win those orders. And then what happened is Shine said, well, fuck it. Instead of letting Zara and H&M make all the choices, let's just show the full scale of what we can do built into our processes right now. And let's just blast that shit out onto the internet and see what happens. And that's what Shine did, I think. And then they started winning. And that's when we started hearing about slave labor practices and how Shine basically needs to be made illegal. And we need to sanction this company. That's where I'm seeing this.
Yeah, it's story. Not the labor; it's the manufacturers that are really special here. And you know, Chinese labor is expensive compared to the rest of Asia.
Yes. So just to report on what we know. Of course, I know firsthand nothing. Right. I just know what we can go off of. What I can say is it looks like there are documented labor abuses. Part of the controversy around that video, that PR video that they put out with the American influencers they brought over to the show, the factory in, I believe that was Guangzhou, The labor abuses are alleged in factories that are outside China. So Vietnam, Malaysia, yep. Indonesia, yep. places like that. So, and it's not implausible. The sheer volume and speed at which these items are produced, you know, there's credibility to some of those claims. I'm fully willing to believe that. The more credible, I guess, concern about an operation of this size is its environmental impact, right? Like this, it's that very obvious.
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
The faster, you know, that's the one that's more credible right. worry. The labor right, one,
we can
faster,
just see that. We can see product, the sheer, yeah. we the can see the sheer around, volume of material that they produce.
That's
that
right.
is, yeah.
People so are presuming a sort of Fordist model of production on this. You know, you have this idea of like the New York textile factories from the turn of the century. That is not how it works. When you have this super fast turnaround, certain batch of products, and you have to be innovative. You have to sort of flip it around really, really quick, right? You have to keep turning it around. And that's just not the sort of setup or conditions for your kind of, you know, the Western imagination of your sweatshop, or even stuff that you can just contract out to households, for example. There was a lot of that in China, you know, mm-hmm. 10, 20 years ago. I don't know about now. I think a lot less, because that's fairly unsophisticated type of production. Yeah. I wanted to pop on Dean's point about these manufacturers, right? I come at this from experience in Malaysia with the tech industry. So I used to sort of advise the work in the Ministry of Education on the entire sort of IT system, and had a very good look at the IT ecosystem around the production of, you know, laptops, projectors, you name it. And a lot of this stuff was going, even back then, this was like mid, early 2000s, so much of that stuff was produced in factories in Taiwan, in South China, and so on. And these guys would, you know, you could tell them whatever you want and they'll build it, right? And then you realize after a while, say laptop manufacturing at that time, they literally would then come up. They don't wait for your specs from HP or whatever. They come up with their menu. Hey, what do you want? I've got this one, this one, this one, right? Already pre-designed. You just slap your brand onto it, okay? It's that degree. They don't have to wait around for you to sort of give them the specs. They were already innovating. People can tell you about, you know, mobile phones. You know, your what is it? These media players. What used to be called the iPod. We had this stuff like that was coming out of Taiwan. It was Hong Kong. Yeah, they had these things.
Famous stories that come out of the relationship between Apple, the production of the iPhone and the iPod in China. I mean, it's a famous story.
You think it came from California, right? They made stuff like this. I saw tablets way before anybody talked about tablets.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know just traveling. Yeah,
they were offering
Korea
it to the Ministry of Education. Okay, here, we made this tablet. You want this? You want that? We can slap anything onto it. Mm-hmm. So it says something. It was about the kind of capitalism you saw. And Shine is the front end for that. I want to talk about this. You know, there's this idea that capitalism works in a certain way, or these businesses, these production networks, or these supply chains work in a certain way. As if it was just the theory is that you have this lead company or an MNC or a transnational company, right, that organizes them all, and they're just there inert and waiting for the order. That's not what I saw. Okay. Yeah, these guys are making stuff. They're coming up with all kinds of shit on their own. Rube Goldberg type things, really weird, interesting stuff. And I think Shine or Temu, whatever, is a window into a lot of this kind of stuff. You know, Teen wrote this piece and he talked about the Shanzai, the, you know, the bandit manufacturer. There's an element of that, you know. There's no clear line between sort of the banditry, counterfeiting, and then innovating, and so on and so forth. But that ability to on a small scale or relatively sort of entrepreneur-owned businesses innovate, this is what Shine and companies like that are front end for. And they'll try out all kinds of stuff. And that's the difference from the model in the US, where you have a giant concern like Amazon was dominating it. And then as it began, you had these well-known brands, right? I think as you said, Jess, the Chinese companies were habituating the American consumer to weird or no-name brands, brands you just heard about yesterday. But then because they could gather reviews, people would buy them. And I and that review system is there. Shine, Temu, Ali, you know, as well. So
yeah, Amazon was the kind of R&D cauldron for this kind of business model, slowly habituating the American consumer, as you stated. I mean, you can see it in their sort of like, you know, it was an axiom in the business development world that if you wanted to sell to an American consumer, you absolutely had to do, you had to present a certain type of image. So things like you had to have proper English. You could not afford to have grammatical mistakes or spelling mistakes. You know, your name had to be evocative and memorable. If you look at an Amazon storefront, you know, I can't, you know, these storefronts just look like someone just banged a keyboard and then came up with the name. Some of the captions are illegible to an American. You know, even the reviews can be terrible. Say the stitching is off, or, you know, I ordered shorts and got, you know, underwear or something. But it was $2.99, so I'm going to stick with it. That was the important lesson that was picked up on. So, you know, there was an element to this little controversy, this little mini controversy that I found interesting, which is almost that people were like defending Shine, like it's kind of an underdog in this, right? I'm sure you guys have picked up on this too. Kind of a lot of people, and I understand the constraints of social media. You end up feeling defensive quite a bit, and if you feel defensive, you're going to go a little bit overboard, and that projects a certain image, and you know, it's a mess.
No, but just I'm not saying that. I wasn't trying to suggest that Shine doesn't engage in labor exploitation. Like, all manufacturers engage in labor exploitation. I'm not saying that, you know, Shine has figured out a way to do this where, you know, the machines are making the clothes automatically and, you know, everyone's a George Jetson pushing buttons. That's obviously not how it works. My point is that this was never brought up with other retailers that use the same system of production, except that they get to control the branding and front end of it. And it wasn't until Shine threatened that everyone suddenly, you know, online, there was this concerted media effort online and in the media and in mass media to suddenly shine a very bright light on the problems of manufacturing textiles. But it's the same manufacturing that's done you know, that's used to supply other brands. And if you look at some of the stuff that Derek Guy was posting, I think it kind of leads to this conclusion.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah, like,
so let me just read about. Let me just read
about two points to that. Though I'm not saying that you're saying anything. I agree with you. I'm saying two things here, very simply. One, these abuses probably are happening, but Shine's business model has exposed the American consumer does not give a shit. So it's not a main concern.
No, I don't care. It's not so much the consumer.
No, yeah. I know. Step two is there's no real need to have a like a moral position on Shine. It's actually just a mere discussion of like brand positioning. Shine was basically saying, you know, giving the middle finger to the traditional brand playbook. Why do I know xenophobia is real? I know racism is real. I think though, in this very particular instance, Shine made a very, very calculated business decision to ignore everything else that brands have been told they need to do precisely to avoid accusations like this. This is what I'm saying. Like, it's not about the xenophobia. It's that Shine intentionally did not care. They had so many tools at their disposal to blunt these, to make it a little bit harder to make these allegations stick, to have it be plausible to the average.
Hey, sorry, we had a dropout. But Jess, sorry, you were saying on that second point?
Oh man, I was really on a roll too. So first is just a strict bifurcation of, you know, the area of concern. I think the full human rights concerns, you know, the slave labor, that's a very elite business class kind of hand-wringing that got a little bit more press, a little bit of attention in the media space. The reality on the ground is most people don't care. Second is that this is I know that Sinophobia is real. I don't mean to discount that or discredit that. I think my interest in this is primarily that Shine made such a concerted, made these calculated business moves, kind of flouting that. There's no way a Chinese company doesn't know the kind of headwinds it faces in the American market. There's no way that they didn't know. There's no way that, and there were so many things that they could have done if to have blunted this kind of controversy, if they actually cared that much about it. Like brands go to extreme lengths. Like Uniqlo is actually a great example of this, to try to build a brand that people would associate with positively and would come to defend. Right, so like a human rights accusation.
But why would Shine invite influencers and come open up its shop floor for people to see? I mean, I haven't seen anyone do that other than Shine. They're the one company that ostensibly opened up its shop floor to show how its manufacturing practices actually work, and then they're the ones that were punished most harshly for that, and it blew up in their face. And I feel like the lesson learned is like, yeah, just keep it all a secret. I mean, don't show them how the sausage is made. Why would you do that?
Yeah, if I were a consultant for them, I would have said, no, you're already in too deep on this. The people who know who you are already have an impression of you. This is not going to change anything. It was kind of cynical and very blatant, actually. I mean, people picked up on it right away. They invited influencers that were of marginalized identities. People noticed right away these were like non-white women who did not fit the traditional mold of, you know, like standard attractiveness, let's say, that one would normally associate with like a clothing brand or influencers who were paid to promote a clothing brand here. And they were all brought in to kind of speak positively about this company. This was bad PR. This was a bad defensive PR move that was bound to actually fail because of their brand positioning to begin with. The thing that they traded on, you know, if they had raised their prices by 30%, if they had spent a little bit, you know, polished their user,
but my point
their
is
user
that,
experience.
But my point
I'm saying
is that
like for this one, they're actually exposing a deep hypocrisy here. They're exposing that the American consumer does not care. It's not a big concern in the end.
I don't agree. I think American consumers do care. I don't think that. I guess what I'm saying is that I do think that it matters that Shine is a company that is a brand that is located in China. And I'm not simply saying that this is we don't like Chinese people. Right. We don't like, you know, squinty eyed chinks. Right. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that the problem is that China happens to also be the base of manufacturing. And it's when you have the folks in the back of the house that start to, you know, take what's made back there and sell it directly in the front of the house. That's when the people in the front of the house get real nasty. That's my point. And that's what I mean by Sinophobia. It's not simple racism. It is, in fact, it's deeply tied to the fact that Shine is a brand that is in the same country, and I think they probably are vertical at this point. It itself
yes, extremely.
Owns a lot of its
You're upsetting
own
the global division of labor.
Correct. We cannot have a company that makes its own shit. That's the problem. And here, look, a couple things. This is what I was about to read, Jess, from Derek Guy. Derek Guy, Dye Workwear. So he wrote a little blurb about fast fashion, and it said, let's define it. Fast fashion is often misunderstood as cheap, mass-produced clothing, but that's not the whole picture. Many companies sell cheap, mass-produced clothing, but aren't fast fashion. For example, Hanes, Dickies, Carhartt, L.L. Bean, Land's End, and so on. Fast fashion isn't just cheap clothing. It's cheap and trendy clothing. The term fast refers to how a company brings a product to market. So I think this is a more honest blurb that he's writing here. His problem, like he said, it's the fast fashion isn't just that it's cheap and mass produced, and therefore he has no objection to Western companies like Hanes, Dickies, Carhartt, L.L. Bean, and Land's End using cheap mass production. His problem is how a company brings a product to market. And I'm saying that when he says how a company brings a product to market, what I don't think he knows this is what he's saying, but I think what is actually being said here is that a company that makes cannot bring the product to market. It has to go through a brand. It has to go through a properly, you know, vetted brand. It can't just be some fly-by-night maker of clothes. And that corresponds to something that someone, when I was tweeting about this, about Uniqlo as a counterexample, they said, well, Uniqlo, you know, China just makes the clothing. Now, there were other things that were said in that tweet, but I just want to focus on just makes the clothing. You see what I'm saying? What I'm trying to point out is that there is a built-in devaluation of the actual making of a product as something that's menial and skillless. There's no human quality in making things anymore. It's pure drudgery. There's no human creativity. There's no joy in making things anymore. It's just brutality. And that's, I think, something that is on the liberal progressive to leftist end of the spectrum. It's not just, you know, your typical Marxism where the laborers are their work is exploited. It's that laborers themselves are not capable of like any other human. There's no humanity in their work. It's, you know, you see what I'm saying?
I do. So you're pointing at like David Graeber talks about this quite a bit. The devaluation of actual productive labor. You know, it is bullshit jobs, right? The hallmark, you know, and it, to the point he makes that, you know, a lot of elite labor in these post-industrial rich societies, one of the tendencies is to then look for people of like highly paid salaried elite workers to then look down on the actual productive workers, despite some nagging understanding that is actually the more useful category of labor. So generally, you're picking up on something real.
And I'm not simply saying that that's the important part of labor. I'm saying that there is a real making things is the basis of human creativity. And I think that when we say that laborers, like Chinese laborers, are just slave laborers, you are stripping them of their humanity. You are not protecting them by saying that they're slaves. You're saying that they're menial, that they lack creativity, they lack passion for their work. They're just abused animals, basically, right? And that fits very neatly into progressive politics.
There's this class element. You can call it race. I mean, it's racial, but the way Teen elucidates it, I start to see this sort of class dimension to it. And it's the role of, you know, this same class, actually, that's very threatened in America right now. A kind of professional managerial class that gets to be the arbiter of taste and that gets to define a brand. You know, these are the symbolic manipulators, right? They don't touch stuff. They don't make things. But their taste or their writing and their discussion, right? Their talk, right? Their work with symbols is the final part of the chain, and they extract the greatest part of the value from the whole process. And something like Shine and this kind of retail just takes it away from them. People go in there and they look at the stuff themselves, and they, you know, the punters, the people, the customers, they see this stuff. It looks cool to them. They are the arbiter of taste here. So it isn't just Shine, and Jess made this great point about Shine not really branding, but they're putting stuff out there. And I don't know, but a consumer going through that also gets to pick and choose and sort of define for herself, you know, the taste there. So you're kind of disintermediating this professional class.
Yes. Yeah. And there is no way to actually criticize Shine or TikTok for that matter without actually exposing a deep kind of seediness to the psyche of the American consumer to begin with. Like, the like, it lends itself easily to conspiracy theories. You know, we've all seen them, you know, the criticism of TikTok that, you know, the CCP is influencing the algorithm. So it produces, you know, it shoves, you know, seedy, trashy elements and boosts that for the American audience. And, you know, if you see it, and, you know, really, you don't have to do that. You don't actually even have to do that. All you have to do is let the consumer, you know, select for themselves what they actually want and boost that. And that has the same effect. It's exposing some kind of cultural, psychological, like I would even put a spiritual, you know, seediness to the heart of the American consumer. We're seeing the lowest common denominator, their market power at work here in a very raw, unmediated, unvarnished way. And I think part of the elite criticism of these companies is partly that these companies actually held up a mirror to where the money actually is in the country and not liking the character of it. And
why does it have to be seedy though? Why is it more seedy than the, you know, people aspiring to brands?
I'm not talking about just because CD. The populism I do not have any problem with, right? That this is the market at work. This is if you claim to like capitalism, then you should have no problem with the market making a decision for itself. What I'm only commenting on is the kind of elite criticism of this. And I will, you know, I'll be open with you. Like if I see Shine, if I go to Shine's site, I look through their clothes, I'm not liking what I'm seeing. There's a particular character and nature to the kind of goods that they are selling. And this is what is, and, you know, I'm not saying that this is, it's easy to, if you are a particular political bent, and this is actually where Sinophobia comes in. This is where it primes people to fall into political traps like this. Like, oh, the CCP wants to turn all of our women into cheap, women who dress like hookers or something, or TikTok. They're trying to corrupt the minds of our youth with trashy content. No, this is simply, you don't even have to do that. Like, let's say that's even
just
what
the beginning,
CCP
though,
wanted.
Right? It's cheaper stuff. And because you're sending stuff from China, it has to be cheaper stuff. But this is just the beginning. What about other things coming through without brands? I'm just referring to, I'm drawing from experience. I mean, I'm old enough to have sort of grown up in Malaysia in sort of with an experience of markets and of capitalism, so to speak, of markets, which were, and many of them literal markets, like night markets and so on, where stuff was not branded. Where you bought things based on price and how it looked like and so on, but and you didn't have this intermediation of brands to this extent, actually not at all. So, you know, my mother would go to a tailor, for example, right? Back then, so you have this thing made to order, or you'd buy something from the night market and it's sort of cheap, but then you could feel it and see, okay, this is good enough for what I want. You know, this Shine stuff, Temu, for example, the stuff they're sort of selling now is cheap and you get the sense, I'm just going to take a risk on it. It's just a few bucks. And I can also return it, they'll give you a refund without any issue.
Yeah,
it doesn't
the
work
risk
out,
to
it's
the
no
consumer
risk. Yes,
is
yes.
low.
It's really low. And that's a big part of it. But that's just the beginning. If the supply chain was sort of strong, if the logistics were stronger, or if you were in China, I could see other categories sort of go this way, an enormous kind of brand disintermediation going on. And
let me offer a framing of what an alternative framing of what's actually going on here. What if Shine is not a brand? And what's going on is, to an extent, that, you know, under influencer culture, individuals are meant to brand themselves now. And I think that what might be going on, Jess, if you go to Shine, I find it overwhelming in its selection that I don't enjoy flipping through websites, you know, online retailers
chaotic.
with such huge amounts of selection. But guess what? That's what brands do. Brands are the ones, you know, with buyers and the ones that flip through, as John said, pre-made items and curate the items out of, you know, the multitudes of items that the producer can make and has made. I select the ones that bring about a certain kind of mystique, a certain kind of emotion, a certain kind of feeling, and I brand it. And but the service that I provide as a brand is going through all that crap. And for a long time,
it's shipping and logistics. Yeah, you're correct.
But I think now that we have a culture where individuals, they want to do that. They want to flip through the bins and figure out what's my personal brand. This is like micro branding at an individual level. And Shine to me is not, oh, I'm a Shine person. I'm not a H&M person. I'm a Shine person. I'm not a Zara person. No. Shine to me is a no brand.
For example, people who.
Yeah, it's like thrifting.
Yeah, thrifting. Yeah.
Well, that's what I think it's
going through bins.
It's funny enough, it's actually importing like 90s Asian retail culture to the American consumer, which I had always learned as being fundamentally impossible. Like the retail experience in Asia is so vastly different than what you are primed to expect in America. Yep. Like in Korea, Marketplace would be the loosest analogy, but it's not what you would expect in English. Like in Korea, it'd be like the shijangs. Massive chaotic stretches of land. Yeah, it just overwhelming in the sheer quantity and depth, the horizontal and vertical depth of the offerings at these marketplaces is coming in as a Westerner, overwhelming.
And the sheer amount of wholesale activity that's going on, right? Yeah. Like sometimes you go to a place and they're like,
Moon, for example.
We're gonna sell you clothing by the pound. Like you gotta put in an order. You can't just buy an article. This is a wholesale market. Okay.
And turns out, this might be a sign of the diminishing power of the American, Americans just don't have the kind of just doesn't have the kind of cash to throw around anymore, or turns out everyone just loved a good deal and everyone is ready to stop paying the excess surplus value for the power of a brand.
Well, that's where I'm disagreeing with you, where I'm saying I don't think it's just price. I think I don't think Costco is necessarily just price either. I think people are, I think there's a significant amount of resentment at the degree to which brands dictates our personal style and our choices, and people want to make choices for themselves. And when you are exposed to the kinds of consumer choices that you can have in Asia, which is now being transmitted to us online, I think it really changes people's attitude around branding. I don't think it's just simply price. And I think this brings to mind, I want to shift gears just for a sec here. This brings to mind when the iPhone first became, this huge mass product, and it was very awkward because the whole thing was built, the entire supply chain for this thing was in China, and Tim Cook, who was the chief operating officer at that time, was always in China managing the supply chain with Foxconn and all the suppliers there. Jess, you remember this, and I've pointed this out to you quite a few times, this very interesting article in the New York Times that recounted a very VIP dinner that took place when Obama was president, and he sat next to Steve Jobs in Silicon Valley. All the Silicon Valley, tech bigwigs had hosted this dinner for Obama. And Obama said to Steve Jobs, look, you tell me what you need from me as the president. What do you need to bring those jobs, making the iPhones, things like that? How do we bring those jobs back to the United States? Answer from Steve Jobs, those jobs are not coming back. It's not simply a matter of price. It's not simply a matter of labor cost, because he's like, look, ultimately, if you break down the cost of the iPhone, labor cost is a relatively small input to the total cost. So, you could pay your workers three times more, which is what you have to pay in America, let's say, but that's not going to really impact the total cost of the phone. The problem is that we don't have the workforce in America to do the things that they're doing in China. Meaning, and he didn't mean like workers that are going to, be willing to work under a whip and get paid
wasn't
shit.
Even
that's
price.
Not, that's not what his point wage. Was. He said skill. We're not producing the engineering skill that's required. And the famous thing, of course, was after they had the whole
glass.
Supply chain. Yes, exactly. They flipped the entire production line over basically overnight to go from plastic screens to glass screens on the eve of product launch. And all of the Apple managers in California were like, you're insane. Steve Jobs is insane. And they did it. And I think that really changed their attitude about whether the iPhone could ever be made in America. And he told Obama, it's not going to happen. So stop asking. You're not just going to pass a few laws and that's going to happen. And it's been proven. Foxconn tried to move a fairly low-tech LCD manufacturing plant to Wisconsin in what was a highly publicized deal under Trump that it never got off the ground. They couldn't make it. I don't think they ever produced a single panel despite billions in tax benefits to Foxconn.
Now, the most notable is there were 20 employees that were paid something like $300,000 US a year. And their literal job description was watching Netflix in the office.
Right.
That was it. Yeah, that's a famous story that gets passed. And in fact, so much time has passed that we're even losing the language to properly describe the scale of the deindustrialization of America. Like when he's talking about skilled labor, and this is something that I've pointed out a few times too. Like engineering in the U.S. is a highly paid luxury profession. It's considered elite. That doesn't make that much sense in Asia. Like I graduated with a mechanical engineering degree. I work as a programmer. That's considered an elite job here. It's paid very handsomely. There aren't very many relative to demand even. What is significantly lacking is an entire middle tier of engineering that sits above, say, a technician, but below the class of engineering that we think of here is like at the very tip top or at the very bottom of the labor chain. There's actually a huge ecosystem of middle tier engineers that we have completely lost. And that is the class of engineer that stepped in to turn around Apple's production line and materials development 2 months before the launch of the iPhone. That's the kind of engineering that I'm talking about. Like I do not have any training in mass production. I don't have any training in any of the stuff. Neither does anybody else in the country, honestly. Nobody has a degree and knows how to manage a factory line. Nobody knows how to do that middle tier of engineering that's actually geared towards, you know, speeding making sure production happens on time and under budget on time and to spec. I was trained entirely on speculative one-offs, extreme, like high end, you know, like it, like, you know, blue sky technology stuff. And I have very little experience with actually, like, if I'm stuck in a factory and I need to ship 10,000 units of something by Friday, I have no idea where to even begin. And that's what we're talking about here. And this is the kind of labor force, the kind of economic and social human capital that China has built up in the decades since we let that go, basically, and never built up.
But there's a great, fascinating part of this discussion, and Teen sort of has begun to bring it out, is that, and to use an ugly word, it's about not just about this producer sort of agency, but on the consumer side, people do a lot more work in Asia. They don't sit back. This is, you know, you go to Dongdaemun Market or you end up somewhere in Shenzhen and you're buying stuff. There's a lot more presumed of you, or there's a lot more interest. It's just like getting on Shine. It may look bewildering, but some people go for it. And in Asia, the experience of the market, so to speak, of capitalism is very much more like that. The consumer, a lot of especially the younger consumers, are not as inert, are not as passive. And that too is part of the end of brands there. I'll give you another example. You know, there was this phenomenon of kids flying to Korea, right? On low cost budget airlines, right? One of which my friend of mine set up, right? AirAsia example. And, you know, they'd come back with bags of stuff and then they'd sell it on Facebook or whatever it was. How did they know what to get? How did they know what was hot? Why were certain things? Well, not because of particular brands. It's because of stuff they'd seen on TV, right? Korean cereals at that time. It could be something else. People go to Indonesia to do this. I know people who go to Guangzhou, right, and buy stuff and do this. So there is a lot of agency on the retail, consumer, and not just the producer level, but on the consumer side and the retail side and the trading side. That's a characteristic of markets and of capitalism, if you will. I don't think capitalism is quite the word for it in East Asia, that people here don't have such a sense of. But they're beginning to get a sense of it with this disintermediation and the ability of companies like Shine, Temu, and others to bring stuff in really, really cheap. It's still through one portal. You still can't do it yourself. You're still sitting in the US clicking. But in Southeast Asia, in anything related to the Chinese market, there's a heck of a lot more agency and creativity. And I say
I mean, the experience.
This is a really good discussion. We're about an hour in. There's still a lot to discuss. If you guys are up for it, I think maybe this might be a good place to end the free portion. And do you want to keep going? And we could kind of do this as a sort of put it into like a bonus time for further talk.
Mm-hmm. Right, I mean, I have time.
Okay. All right.
John, are you okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Let's keep this good.
This is the end of part one of this podcast. We're going to do parts two and maybe parts three, because this ended up being a pretty long discussion on the Patreon feed. If you want to access and support us on Patreon, go to patreon.com/planemech.